were we able to get all the connections that we needed?
Okay,
fantastic. Attribute that to the opening prayer, because I'll tell you, technology is fun. Another thing that's fun is math. Why? It's kind of a nebulous thing. It's a little bit intangible, if you think about it. It's numbers that are out there. In fact, if you go back to the history, there are people who be like, well, the newest number is this concept of zero, this whole math thing. How do you get it? I remember going through and you've got calculus with imaginary numbers. You're like, what? What if you're earlier than that? You're like, negative numbers. How do you even get these sort of concepts? But this idea of math, as intangible as it might be, is really baked into us as human beings. We grasp math, even if we might not grasp calculus or higher level things of that nature. But we're of measurement, of fairness, of reciprocity, you know, that equal sign. Something on this side is equal to that side. If you put a scale, and God has a lot to say about scales, if you have even scales or not, but this whole idea that if you give me this, I will give you that. It's an equation. It's a mathematical equation of what it is. Understand that equality and fairness and evenness is fantastic. But the funny thing about that is even though we grasp that, we all want more than what the other person has. We want it to be heaped and overflowing on our side. We're selfish as human beings, generally speaking. Now, there are some anomalies. We are there. For us, it's almost like, you know, the concept of a zero-sum battle, if you're familiar with that. The idea that you can't have two winners, right? This whole idea of a tie. They used to have ties in sports games, and they're like, nope, we got overtime. Double overtime. There will not be a tie. Somebody has to win. And so you can't both be winners, so somebody has to be the winner, and somebody has to be the loser. Now, this manifests in, obviously, sports, war, arguments, in our thought processes, all those human interactions that we have. Social scientists often find that it makes people uncomfortable when there is an inequality in a relationship. Like, if you're the person who is constantly receiving the free meal because your friend is paying, now that might be okay because they're extenuating circumstances, but if something in a relationship moves past to where it's like, oh, there isn't an extenuating circumstance, it can get to be awkward. If you're always the one who's paying for it and you won't ever let someone else pay for the meal, that can also make things awkward because the equation is not balanced. It's not even on both sides. Now, it can be really easy to see this. I mean, you and I, we are not selfish like this. We don't function like this. And so when we see it in others, it's glaring. We recognize it. And I think that sometimes it's really easy to see in infants because they can't talk back to you yet. And so I've got an infant at home. You can see these tendencies of selfishness. It's like they want something. They want it now. Babies are very needy. They're very selfish. And you know, they're very dependent upon everybody around them. They really are, they're net consumers. They don't produce anything yet. They're just there. They expect other people to care for them. Like, my daughter wants to be held. Nope, not by you, by the other person, or however it moves around. Babies are like they know what they want. They can be demanding, they can be selfish, they can want things, and they make it very clear. But there's an expectation, though, that you would be caring for them, that an adult is going to be caring for them. Been thinking about this, and let's turn over to Matthew 18, because when we think about little kids, we think about selfishness, we're thinking about all these things that we as Christians ought to be doing. And I refer to little kids lovingly as ground slugs, because for like the first 4 to 6 months, you put them down, they don't move. It's like the best. It's the best, because you don't have to worry about where they're going to end up. You can put them down and things are great. But then locomotion happens, and they start moving. I think it was within the last week, my daughter discovered how to move what we had put in front of the basement door to open the basement door. The week before that, she had learned how to open doors, and so she's doing all these things, moving around. But they start moving and they start getting into things. But we're told in Matthew 18, very beginning of the chapter there, first five verses, Jesus has his disciples. They're asking a question. Who then is going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus called a little child to him and set him in the midst of them. And he said, "Assuredly, I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me." I wonder how little the child was. Just because that transition point in the life of a child is very fast. When it moves from being the little ground slug that you can play somewhere and it like really depends on you for everything. Net consumer. And they rely on the adults in their life to be around. But then it shifts. Like kids, if you're trying to teach math to kids, right, that's a difficult thing. Kids don't grasp this whole math concept as easily, and if you're trying to teach them, it slowly works into their brain. But what does click for them is that relationship dynamic that we talked about. This person cares for me. This person loves me. This person provides for me. This person protects me. All these things register in the kid's mind so that when something happens, who does the kid go to? The individual who's providing those things, right? This person. So even though they're like net consuming, everything's coming in, they're not giving something back other than oxytocin and love to their parents, right? They're not giving things back, but what they do know, what is there in that balance or that equation, it's very offset. They're just getting everything given to them. But then what the child does know is they know who cares for them. And we're told here in Matthew 18 that we're to become like a child. And obviously the passage goes on and talks about humility. It talks about becoming humble like that child. But all you have to do is hang around a little bit longer with a kid. And they move from ground slug phase to where they depend on you for everything. And they'll be lovingly cooing and smiling. And they move and they shift from being an infant and a baby who's just squishy and like beautifully reliant upon you to something else. They shift from that young little thing to something else. Let's go to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6. Pick it up in verse 25. Matthew chapter 6, verse 25. Jesus here speaking right after he gives the Beatitudes in Matthew 5, he says, "Therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing?" It's interesting because our youngest is 15 months. She's about that age. She's right around a year and a half, right? And she's still reliant on us. But you start to see coming out a desire. She's like, there's no question in her mind that she's going to get food. It's just she wants that food. No, she doesn't want this food. She'll shake her head yes or no on what she's asking for. She'll ask for more of other things. But then you move up in age. And I think I've shared before that I've had conversations with my children where we're going out, we're doing something, we're in the car, and they'll ask if I'm going to get them food. Or did we pack something? And in my mind, I go like, that's my responsibility as a parent, is it not? I'm supposed to provide for you. Why would I not? Have I ever let you just starve yourself silly? Other than on the Day of Atonement, right? You eat every day. Why would you have to ask the question? So you move from it's like this understanding that the child is being provided for to this, are you really going to do that for me? You know, they haven't started asking this about clothing or anything like that, but I know, like, down the road, like, as they become more autonomous, as they venture out and they're more real human beings, you know, they grow up into being an actual human being, they get more abilities. All of you, you know, you want to be the tallest, they like to see where they are, but worrying is not going to add one cubit to our stature, so then why do we worry about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin, and yet I say to you that even Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these. Now, if God so clothes the grass, you're thinking about this, you're worried about these things. Now, if God clothes the grass of the field, which today is, and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? Therefore, do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? You know, your sustenance. This is where I go, child. It says little child. It wasn't just a young, I don't know. It doesn't clarify. I tried to look and see, like, to figure out how young the child was in Matthew 18. But it's like, a little child relies on, needs, and in many respects, there isn't a question. It's just, that's who is going to care for them. And if you're going to do it right now, right? So temporality is more the thing with the little kids when they're looking at these. But as we get older, as we become more capable, we seem to start to question things. Are you going to give me something to eat? Are you going to give me something to wear? What are we going to drink? After all these things, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. This can sometimes be humorous because you're told, well, don't worry about those little things like food and protection and clothing, right? You know, the little stuff. But they're quite big. They're quite big, and we see those manifest in the lives. I get to see them manifest in the lives of my children, but we probably, if we look and we're introspective, we see it in our own life as well. We grow, we mature, we progress from being little ground slugs and fully reliant upon someone else to care for us, to protect us, to change us, all those things. And then we move to this point where we begin to question. We question who is going to be there, who will do it. And as we get even older than that, what we might do is we set up walls within our relationship. I would never allow that to happen to me again. I was taken advantage of. I have to protect myself. Maybe you went through lack in your life growing up. You're like, you know what? I am always going to make sure that I have an emergency fund fully set up so that I will never have to worry about going, you know, into debt. Or someone took advantage of me. And so we might do these things where we start to take on the responsibility of providing for ourselves the food, the shelter, the clothing, the drink. Because, you know, we're adults. We're getting big. And we set up these things. It can seem that in order for us to survive, instead of relying on someone else, what we start to do is we engage in this zero-sum battle. Because we have to make sure that we have what we need. And if we're trying to get what we need, everything around us, whether it's time, our energy, finances, any of those resources, it's either we have them or someone else has them, oftentimes. Because if I'm holding my daughter, it's kind of funny during the songs, I was watching, my brother-in-law is holding my daughter, his wife is holding their son, and they're looking at each other. The babies, the little kids are looking at each other, it's like, hold on. Why is my parent holding you, right? And you get that because you're like, well, you got two arms, you got two parents. But we start to develop this awareness, this mindset. I shouldn't even call it awareness. We develop this mindset that it's almost like it's me or you. I have to be able to have this. I've had a lot of conversations here over the last couple of weeks. The example that Mr. Kanako left, he gave so much to so many people. And he always seemed to have more. And you're like, oh, how did he do that? How did he do that? How did he just keep giving? Because it's an example that I am trying to do a better job of emulating. And I don't do a very good job of that. It's like, I feel like my resources are finite. Oh, I have to give this to my family. Oh, I have to give this to the job. Oh, I have to give this. And there's not enough. It manifests in so many different ways to where we'll start to pull back and we start to pull in because the equation isn't balancing and that makes us feel awkward. And it's a difficult thing. But God tells us to become more like a child. Because in that ground slug phase, it's a beautiful thing. Because there's no equation. It doesn't even come into mind. It does not even come into mind. They're not sitting there going like, well, if I do this, I'm going to fill up my account. No, it's just like, this is what I need right now. Dad, Mom, will you provide me with that? So they cry out and they ask for it. If we look at what we're called to do, I think the funny thing about Christianity is it will never add up. The equation for Christianity is not a balanced one. It was never made to be a balanced one. But our human nature is constantly looking for that equality and for the equation to be balanced. And that's something that we have to put behind us and out of our minds if we're going to really all in, jump into following God's way. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 15. Deuteronomy chapter 15. Probably didn't say the scriptures enough because I saw them popping up on the screen. So for those who are taking notes or don't see the screen, I apologize. Let's go to Deuteronomy 15. Slow it down here a little bit. As children, when we're called to become like children, you could say it's a regression. Maybe in some fashion it is. But God is asking us to say, hey, will you rely on me? It's a wonderful question. I've talked about this when I've talked about the covenants and what God is really asking in the various covenants. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about the Adamic covenant or the Noahian covenant or the Abrahamic or the Mosaic or that you can go to every single covenant you could possibly look at in Scripture. And the very core essence of each of those is one question. Am I willing to trust God? Am I willing to trust God? That is the core of every single covenant that He has. Will you trust me to give you truth and protection and food? Adam and Eve said, nope, I'd like to decide that for myself. For each and every one of us, that is the question. He's continually asking, do you trust me? And we see so many examples in Scripture of where He poses an opportunity for His children to learn that. Here in Deuteronomy chapter 15, verse 7 is where we'll pick it up. Deuteronomy chapter 15, verse 7. He says, if there is among you a poor man of your brethren, within any of the gates in your land which the Lord your God has given you, you shall not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your poor brother. But you shall open your hand wide to him and willingly lend him sufficient for his need and whatever he needs. Beware, I was going to give a side note, but God actually covers it here with what Moses recorded. He says, beware, lest there be a wicked thought in your heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release. Remember, there was only a certain amount of time. Every 7 years, you got seven series of sevens that got you to the Jubilee year. But he says, beware, lest there be a wicked thought in your heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release is at hand, and your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing, because you're not going to get enough time and work out of him. That equation is just not balancing out in your favor. Because if you're going to buy out his debt and you're going to let him be an indentured servant to you, but you're only going to get 6 months, I'll let somebody else do that. Right? Oh, it's not going to work out in my favor. But he says, don't give him nothing. So beware lest there be a wicked thought in your heart, saying the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing. And he cry out to the Lord against you, and it becomes sin. Boom, to grow there. And if you see somebody who's irresponsible in an area of their life, you're like, oh, that's an area I would not be willing to risk my resources of time, my resources of finance, my resources of advice. Like, oh, that's an area I'm not willing to risk that. It's the same thing that God is saying here. It's like, generally, humanly, investment. God says, I don't care. Don't look for that equation. I want you to go back to this mindset before you were thinking like that. Before you had to worry about what you were going to eat, what you were going to wear, where you were going to live. and I want you to care for them. That makes no sense. That doesn't add up. You look at things, you're like, wow, we're honest about where we are. We shouldn't be where we are. It doesn't add up. And so God says, hey, you should behave differently. We see this brought out in Proverbs 19, this concept from Deuteronomy of giving to the poor their opportunity. And in Proverbs 19, verse 17, we see here a really interesting concept, because nobody likes to make a risky investment, right? You're like, ooh. Sometimes you put it in, you're like, well, I'm playing a long game. I'll let it be riskier now. I'll get more conservative later on. Says about this. He says it in Proverbs 19, verse 17. He says, he who has pity on the poor, you're giving to the poor, is lending to the Lord, and he will pay back what he has given. You know, God says never enter into an agreement with somebody, with a fool. And he's saying be wise, but be careful about who you are going into a contract, or a legally binding contract, or a financial agreement with. But this is an interesting thing, because he says, you know what? Give to the poor. Lend to them, because I'm going to take care of you. The beautiful thing about this is God makes good on his promises, right? Just like a parent. Are you going to leave the baby or the kid who's your responsibility to make? Nope, just don't feel like feeding you today. Just didn't want to. That's not what God does. He cares for us. He provides for us. He says, you know what? If you're going to change your mindset from trying to make sure that you're taken care of and that you've got something coming back to you, if you will throw that out of the equation, don't let that be a part of your calculus, and instead recognize that when you give to the poor, you're actually lending to me. And I got no problem paying you back whatsoever. Luke 12, verse 22. Like I said, God is continually asking us, do we trust him? Would we trust him enough, like, to do an outwardly unwise investment? Lend to somebody who you're like, there's no way that's coming back. Well, that one's gone. Maybe be a little bit sour about it. Hold on to it for a while. Keep dredging it up. Let them know that you know they're never going to repay you. You know, there are all sorts of ways we can do this. And again, it's not just financial, because we can do this relationally as well. We can do this emotionally. We can put people on the outs. But Matthew chapter 12, verse 22, this is a wonderful concept. It actually carries on from Matthew 6. But Luke chapter 12, verse 22. He says to his disciples, therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, nor about the body, what you will put on. Life is more than food, and the body is more than clothing. Consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, which have neither storehouse nor barn, and God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than the birds? And which of you, by worrying, can add a cubit to his stature? If you then are not able to do the least, why are you anxious for the rest? This is the wording here that Luke gives is a little bit different. I think it's hilarious, because he's like, well, if you can't even change the small things, why are you worrying about the other things? Verse 27, consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. And yet I say to you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. If then God so clothes the grass, which today is in the field and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? And do not seek what you should eat or what you should drink, nor have any anxious mind. For these things, all these things, the nations of the world seek after. See, this is a mindset of someone who is not following God. For the nations of the world seek after, and your Father knows that you need these things. Do not fear, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. This is really interesting when you think about the spring holy days and the march of the children of Israel through the wilderness towards the promised land. It is God's good pleasure to give them. What was the promised land? It was abundance. It is God's good pleasure to give abundance. Why are you worried about this small thing? God is going to take care of you. And he says, sell what you have, give alms, provide yourselves money bags, which do not grow old, a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches, nor moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Verse 32 to 34 is something that's added beyond what we read about in Matthew 6 a little bit earlier. It says, do not fear, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. His desire is to do that. When we worry about where we are, what we have, and how even that equation is, we're missing something. He says, don't worry about that. Don't fear about that. Here's what God's overall desire is. Just like when I tell my kids, yeah, I'm not going to let you starve. We're going to do this. It's going to be okay. You're going to have a bed. You're going to have a pillow. You're going to have all the things that you need. But then he goes on, and this is a interesting. Let's go to Matthew 19, because what Jesus is teaching here in Luke 12 is reiterated in Matthew 19 in his discussion with a young man, not a young child, not a little child, but a young man, Matthew 19, verse 16. Matthew chapter 19, verse 16. We have here his counsel to the rich young ruler. It says, now behold, one came and said to him, good teacher, what good thing shall I do that I may inherit or may have eternal life? He says to him, why do you call me good? No one is good but one, that is God. But if you want to enter into life, keep the commandments. And he said to him, which ones? And Jesus said, you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, and you shall not bear false witness. Honor your father and your mother, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. The young man says, all these I have kept from my youth. What do I still lack? And here's what Jesus tells him. If you want to be perfect, go, sell what you have, give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come, follow me. What's he asking? So you've done those things. Do you trust me enough to provide for you? Are you okay with it seeming like it's an uneven equation in your life? You have so much right now. Where is your faith? Is your faith in your things? Again, taking on that mindset of a child. And the man goes away because he's very sorrowful, for he had great possessions. Taking on the mindset of what God is looking for, his children, it requires us to go in opposition to so much of how this world is set up. It's not set up. This equation is not set up in a fashion that makes sense to us. Because again, we're sitting going like, well, if I want to be okay, if I'm going to protect myself, this goes on especially we're getting closer and closer to the return of Christ, and you see so much happening in the world around us. It's like, well, what is going to happen when everything goes awry? And there are some individuals who are stockpiling guns. There are some individuals who are stockpiling, you know, they bury gold in their yard. They have all the things to make sure that they're fully off-grid. And I'm not saying to not do those things. But they're all trying to, in some fashion, make sure that they have what they think that they need, instead of a different mindset, the mindset that God is trying to cultivate in each and every one of us. That equation, again, if we were to look at it, doesn't add up. It will never, should everybody knows if it's going to be a public thing, because I mean, then you're not only investing but financially to do a good thing, but also everybody else around you knows. And so the equation is up, up, up. It's fantastic. Look at that great person. But verse 42, then one poor widow came and threw in two mites, which make a disciples to himself. And he said to them, assuredly I say to you that this poor widow has put in more than all those who have given to the treasury. For they all put in out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, put in all that she had, her whole livelihood. To watch my children do this, because to some extent, for all the math and all the opportunities, they don't understand money like I understand money, or other adults might understand money. And you get to watch a different mindset, a different relationship with that equation, that finances is an easy way to exemplify this, but it happens in so many other ways. You will watch kids give so much love and so much energy while we might hold back. They will have emotive responses that go above and beyond, big emotions, little kids, big emotions, and we'll be like, oh, restrain you. But then there's also there's a joy that is there. There's a love that is there. There is something that as we look through things, as adults, we go through time, we pull back. We're trying to make sure that we're taken care of. And what Jesus is saying here with the widow, he's like, oh, she gave out of her poverty all that she had. She had a different mindset. She wasn't sitting there stacking things up. Well, I can afford to give this much and I can do this. She's like, this is what God has given me. I'm giving it back to God. Again, God is continually asking, do we trust Him? Do we trust Him? Let's go to Malachi. Malachi chapter 3. As we consider our Christian walk and what God has brought us along, the beauty and maybe perhaps frustration, they can happen concurrently, is that almost nothing about God's way adds up. Almost nothing. Because it just, logically to our brains, doesn't make sense. And it's kind of because it's very parallel to trying to cover this concept of value or money or the math equation, with our kids. They don't grasp it yet. At least not in the way that we as adults do. Here in Malachi chapter 3, we see something else that makes absolutely no sense. Malachi chapter 3, verse 10, this is given to the individuals. This is after their exile into Babylon. They've come back. So you have those of Judah and some from Levi and Benjamin who have come back from captivity. And they knew why they went into captivity. There are things you can go look through the reforms of Ezra and Nehemiah and what they were doing and how they had to come back and kind of like relearn what they needed to do. But you also see that there was a tenacity for following God and all the things that He said to do. I believe it was Nehemiah who had to sit there and throw individuals out of the temple complex, saying, that house is not for you. That room is not for you. That is supposed to be where we store the portion for the Levites, the portion for God, for the offerings. Get out. So he had to clean up the house of the Lord. But we have here in Malachi chapter 3, verse 10, it says, bring all the tithes into the storehouse. Malachi chapter 3, verse 10. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse so there may be food in my house. And try me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it. That makes no sense financially. I mean, to live off of 70 to 80% of your income, after you've already paid taxes on the first portion of it before that, and then to get, what are we, about 8 3/4 to 10% around here for every other purchase that you're doing, like how do you live off of that? It doesn't add up. If you talk to anyone who's gone through a third tithe year, that definitely does not add up. Having some of the conversations with individuals this week as you find out the difficulties that they're going through, and they say, oh, and then this happened. Well, what inspired the person to do that? Why is that how it turned out? It makes no sense. And yet, there it is. We probably likely all have examples of that and stories that we could share from our life where we say, you know what? If I consider that and I think about that, I can look at it and say, there's no way that that adds up. There's no way that that makes sense. Logically, it should not be, and yet it is. And yet it is. Nothing about God's way lines up that way or adds up that way. We have the challenge then of figuring out how to give of our time, give of our energy for things that might seem to be lost causes. Again, I mentioned I struggle with this when you're looking at trying to figure out where to put your energies, what to do, and like, do I have enough Do I have enough to give to that? For things that don't seem like a wise endeavor. Let's go to Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10. And this is where that equation begins to shift. Because as much as math is can be a hard concept, can be a nebulous, intangible thing, the way that you make math relatable is you bring in physical things. They have them, if you're ever in the classroom, they call them math manipulatives, and you can bring in the little blocks and you can stack them up here. You can start to see, well, this number by this number gives you the area, and this number plus this number, these are the ones, these are the tens, these are the hundreds. And you start to grasp this concept of the equations that you're building when you're teaching math. And one of the interesting things is that we have that same opportunity as children to learn that with God. Matthew chapter 10, verse 6 is where we'll begin. Matthew chapter 10, verse 6. Jesus is sending out his 12 apostles. And he commanded them, saying, "Do not go into the way of the Gentiles, and do not enter a city of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as you go preaching, saying, 'The kingdom of heaven is at hand,' heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out demons. Freely you have received, freely give. Provide neither gold nor silver nor copper in your money bags, nor bag for your journey, nor two tunics, nor sandals, nor staffs, for a worker is worthy of his food." Goes right back to Matthew chapter 6, goes right back to Luke chapter 12. Don't worry about what you're going to eat, what you're going to drink, what you will wear. It says, "I will provide for you." The beauty of this is that if they're going out and they're doing this and they're trusting that God is going to provide for them, what ends up coming back is that as they preach a message of hope, as they exemplify this gospel of hope of the kingdom, is that the people who are receiving this see the value of it and care for them according to the value that they see. You start to see the equation. You say, "Oh, God took care of me here. God asks for obedience. God protected me. God provided for me. God," and you start lumping things onto this equation. You begin to see. And this is one of those things where if you have a kid and you're like, "Well, you've got a whole stack of cookies," and you just, "These are my cookies. I want to have a cookie every day for the whole month." Well, now it's you versus them. Right? Or is there a way, and the other idea, like you teach a man to fish sort of concept, is like you can do things together. You're either going to fight with each other over the limited resources, or you're going to figure out a way, or we're going to figure out a way to work together. What Jesus is teaching his disciples here is going out. It's like, I mean, what endeavor do we ever go into? We're told, count the costs. Consider what man building a tower is going to go and do that if he hasn't first counted the cost, or who's going to send out an army if he hasn't first figured out whether he has enough men to grasp. I should take away that qualifier. I shouldn't say as kids. Because as human beings, it can be a very difficult thing for us to grasp. I said at the beginning, it's easier to see it in other people. It's harder for us to see it in ourselves. If we admit to ourselves, math is hard. That's difficult. But if you're thinking about your Christian walk and you're thinking about what you and I have each been called to do, we don't really fully grasp those mathematical concepts either. Because it's likely that we're withholding in some fashion the amount that we could give, what we could do in going to conversations with Annie, talking about what Mr. Knuckle did and all the people he wrote letters to, all the people he kept in touch with over his 65 years in God's church. And he just kept going. He just added more to it. Like, how? How did he have the availability? Like, my carnal human brain does not wrap around how someone keeps giving like that without asking, "Hold on, do I have enough left for someone else?" And the only answer is exactly what Jesus tells his disciples in this discussion here in Matthew. I lost my spot here. Verse 8. second half. He says, freely you have received, freely give. When that happens, when we buy into that aspect of the equation, then it doesn't matter, because you don't have to provide gold or silver or other things, because God provides it. Put the tithes into the storehouse, and God says, I will open heaven and I will provide for you. It's a difficult leap to make, because it requires the one thing that God is constantly asking from each and every one of us. Do you trust me to provide for you? Do you trust me in all those areas of our life? Do we trust him? There is an amazing blessing of having the mind of a child. When he told all those who were there, he says, oh, you want to argue about who's going to be the greatest? Bring a young child, a little child, sit on the lap. He says, you know what? If you will humble yourself as this child, you will be the greatest in the kingdom. There is a blessing to the naivety of a child when it comes to that mathematical equation of what I have versus what I need. We all need to have that naivety, if you will. Because this world revolves around money. It revolves around trying to pay your mortgage. You can come up with all these reasons why, well, like, oh, kids don't understand, because they don't have bills. They don't pay utilities. They don't have to get there to make sure they have a mortgage payment. They just don't get it yet. When they're older, they'll grasp it. I'm not saying don't teach our kids to be responsible about finances. But it's like, they don't get it now. Well, we could say the same thing about ourselves. Because God is offering the same thing. He's like, why are you asking me if I'm going to feed you? Have I not continued to feed you? Have I not continued to care for you? Freely you have received, freely also we should give. Let's close off. Let's go back to Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12. Verse 22. Christ says to his disciples, therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, nor about the body, what you will put on. Life is more than food, and the body is more than clothing. Consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, which have neither storehouse nor barn, and God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than the birds? And which of you, by worrying, can add one cubit to his stature? If you then are not able to do the least, why are you anxious for the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. And yet I say to you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. If then God so clothes the grass, which today is in the field and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? Do you seek what you should eat or what you should drink? Nor have anxious and do not seek. Or what you should eat or what you should drink, nor have anxious mind. For all these things the nations of the world seek after, and your Father knows that you need these things. But seek the kingdom of God, and all these things will be added to you. If we follow this, this is where Christianity adds up. This is how it makes sense. Let's make sure that we have this mindset of giving freely, just as we have received freely.